Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Last time we were talking about gradient descent, which was this very simple optimization algorithm for finding the minimum of a differentiable function. And we had just finished by talking about the difference between batch and online gradient descent, which just had to do with whether you looked at all of the training examples before you updated the parameters, or whether you updated the parameters every time you saw an individual training example. So now that we've talked about some different variants of gradient descent, I just wanted to finish this part up by talking about some of the problems that this has a simple optimization procedure. And so that's why, and you know, because of these problems, the gradient descent is nice because it's simple and you can apply it, it's easy to code up and you can apply it to a large variety of problems. But for lots of practical optimization problems, people tend to use more complex methods that we won't go into, but I'll at least go into some of the problems with gradient descent that motivate some of these more complex methods. So the first problem that we've already discussed is that you have this little step size parameter that says how far you have to go, how big a step you take in the gradient direction. And we've seen an example that shows if you set it too big, you fly off to infinity. If you set it too small, you don't go anywhere. So you have to find some intermediate value. There are theoretical results about this, but they don't give you a lot of help in practice. So typically the best thing you can do is try a number of different step sizes and see if you get convergence or not. Now the second problem I want to talk about is this thing, another problem that can fool gradient descent, and that's this problem called shallow valleys. So say I have an objective function that looks like this, so maybe it's in two dimensions, so x1 is here, or w1 is here, w2 is coming off the screen, I'm trying to minimize this function e. So you see this slopes a little bit down here, so the minimum of e is somewhere off here, off to the left, or off to the left. So if I follow the gradient, what I'm going to do, say I start here, and then I follow the gradient. So what's going to happen is this part of it kind of looks like a plane. So you're actually going to go, and it's pretty steep. So you're going to go down pretty quickly and get to the bottom of this valley. But once you hit the bottom of the valley, suddenly the norm of the gradient is going to become very, very small. So then what's going to happen is even with the same step size, the steps that I take in parameter space are going to be really big when here, but then they're going to be really small once I get here. So it's hard to have, you know, any particular value of the step size is not going to work very well in this case. You'll either fly off to infinity up here if your step size is really big, or if it's smaller, then you'll go really slow when you're here. So there is kind of a hack to deal with this. I don't want to talk a lot about it, but you know, if you're coding up neural networks or something like that, which we'll talk about next week, then it's something you'll want to use. It's this thing called the momentum. And what it means, I'm not going to go through it. I'm not going to go through the equation in detail. That's not really necessary. But basically what it means is that you maintain a memory of the previous gradients that you've gone down. And so if you see the same, if the gradient points in the same direction over and over again, you slowly accelerate in that direction. So if you imagine the reason it's called momentum is if I imagine putting a marble down here, the previous gradients are kind of like, they add up to the kinetic energy of this little marble. So this is something, it's kind of a hack. It can be very useful in practice. It can be useful in practice, but it turns out it adds another parameter, which is like in addition to step size eta that you have to set, now you have this thing beta that you have to set. And that can be a little bit irritating. The other kind of problem that gradient descent can have is even though the gradient is locally the steepest direction, that doesn't mean that it points towards the optimum. And the common example where you see this is what's called curvature. So if I have a distribution, for example, this would arise if I have a distribution where the variables are highly correlated. So this is a contour plot of an objective function. So again, think of this as being W1 in this axis, W2 in that axis, like that. And these are the level sets. So you should think of a quadratic bowl coming up from the screen, but it's going to be very, very long and skinny, the bowl. So it turns out that if I take a gradient of a bowl that looks like this, it's going to point something like that. So it turns out that, you know, because the gradient is, or the negative gradient points in the direction of steepest descent, that means that it's always going to be perpendicular to the level sets. So the gradient's always going to point in this direction. I mean, if you don't believe me, just come up with a quadratic function that looks like this and compute what the gradient is. But the minimum's all the way over here. So what happens when you try to do gradient descent is you kind of zigzag. You know, you might go something like this, and then something like this, and something like this, and you make steps that look like this. You never really go straight to the optimum. So it turns out that there are ways you can deal with this that use more complicated optimization methods that we won't go into. The final problem that you have with gradient descent, which is really important to know about, is this problem of local minima. If you remember from calculus, if I have a point at which the derivative of a function is zero, that is a sufficient condition for being a global optimum, but it's not a necessary condition. So for example, if I have some really wiggly function that looks like this, you know, all of these points have gradient zero. So gradient descent will just stop there because it's got nowhere to go. And these are all local minima, but they're not global minima. And in fact, even if I'm at a place up here that's a local maximum, you know, gradient descent still isn't gonna go anywhere, because which direction would it go in? The gradient is zero. So you'll only converge to a stationary point of the distribution. Now, the functions that we've talked about in this course, like squared error and the log likelihood for logistic regression, have been special. And the way in which they've been special is it turns out that any local minimum is a global minimum. So there's only one, they don't have multiple bowls like this. They can only have one big bowl that with one minimum. But there are some more complex functions, objective functions, that we'll talk about next week, where this isn't the case, where you don't have this this special property. And this property is called convexity, but we won't. You know, but I'm not going to give you the formal definition of that. So if you do have a function that has local minima like this, there's no great solution. You know, even if you say I'm not going to use gradient descent, I'm going to use some other really fancy optimization algorithm, there's not one that can really solve this problem. And the reason is that in order to really have an efficient solution, you need some kind of global characterization of the function, right? You know, typically an optimization algorithm is very myopic, right? It doesn't see this whole graph. It just sees the current value and maybe the gradient, and maybe some other information. But you're only seeing things that are kind of local to this point. So you don't know what's happening in the rest of parameter space. So usually the best you can do is to try running your optimization algorithm multiple times from different starting points. But you still never know if you've actually found the global minimum. Okay, so as I've talked about, like some of these problems can be fixed by more complicated methods and some of them can't. So this problem of shallow valleys and curved objective functions can be solved by a number of kind of fancy methods that I put the names up on the slides, but they're not covered in this course. So there are things like, you know, Newton's method or quasi-Newton methods, or conjugate gradient. So methods like those are the ones you would actually use, say, in Weka to solve the logistic regression problem. But you know, in order to, you know, to understand what's going on, it's enough to understand gradient descent. But it's kind of good to know that what's actually going on in Weka is a little bit more complicated than gradient descent. And as I said, if you've got a function with a lot of local minima, then you just have to give up and find the best local minimum that you can. There's no easy answer to that. A final topic that's going to become important in this lecture is we've always talked about an unconstrained optimization problem. So this is an optimization problem where I just have some function and I want to, you know, I want to maximize this with respect to the arguments. But lots of times you might have constraints on these things you're trying to, on the variables that you're trying to maximize. So maybe only certain values of the variables make sense. A very simple example of this is maximum likelihood in a Gaussian distribution. In the first week, we talked about deriving a maximum likelihood estimator for the mean of a Gaussian distribution. And we found, well, that was just take the sample mean. That was very easy. So if you want to get the maximum likelihood estimator for the variance or for the standard deviation, that is, again, the estimator is actually very, very simple. It's close to what you would expect, but deriving it is a bit more complicated. And the reason for that is that standard deviations have to be positive. If I didn't put this, so the maximum likelihood problem is actually a constrained optimization problem where I want to maximize. So say I have, so here in this example, I have two data points, and I want to derive the maximum likelihood solution, so I can maximize the log likelihood. But if I didn't put a constraint, then I could just take sigma squared to zero, and this thing would get really, really big. Or I could even take it, you know, it would, I could even have negative values of this that wouldn't make any sense. So what you need to do is, you need a constrained optimization problem. You need a way to deal with this constraint, and that uses a particular kind of maths that we also won't talk about in this course, which is called Lagrange multipliers. But I'm bringing this up now just so you know that there is some kind of, at least so if I show you an optimization problem like this, you can see that later on, you can see that, okay, there are techniques that you can think of as black boxes that are numerical methods for solving problems like this. But those are going to be too advanced for us to go through in this course. Okay, so this has been kind of, very, very surface view of optimization. If you really wanted to get into it, it's pretty complex. What I suggest you take away from this is do not implement your own optimization algorithms if you can help it. A lot of toolkits, like if you're actually programming things in Weka or if you're using MATLAB, there are already implementations there of some of these more advanced implementation algorithms, optimization algorithms, that I'm not going through. So what I'm really hoping for you to understand is, you know, why we have made this move to convert learning problems into continuous optimization problems, and at the kind of simple and kind of the simple gradient descent methods to solve it and how they run into problems. That's what I'm really hoping for you to take away. So are there any questions about the optimization, anything in optimization? Because I'm going to move on to the next topic. Yeah. So the difference is that this might not, so I might have a function that just does this. There could only be one point where the gradient's zero, but it's just, here, the gradient has small norm. Right, so if I have some function that, so let me just take, how is this gonna, if I do, So it could be, I've only shown, I didn't show the minimum of this function, but it could be that the function looks something like this. All right, so if I have some, so here's going to be the edge of the valley here, and then there's the minimum, and now it's going to start going up, except more shallowly than that, and then you get a quadratic bowl here. So there's still only one minimum that's here, but getting there could be very, very slow. Is that, yeah. Good. Is there anything else? Okay, so in the rest of this lecture, I'm going to talk about a couple different linear classification algorithms. And the first one that I'm going to talk about is this very old classification algorithm. It's kind of historically interesting, and it's useful for understanding neural networks, and that is the perceptron algorithm. So what the perceptron algorithm is, it's going to be a linear classifier. But we start with saying, well, can we do something that's simpler than logistic regression? You know, if I don't want to understand any of this, you know, optimization, whatever, I just want, you know, a simple algorithm that I can code up. Well, we had this problem where we had to do this numerical stuff with a gradient, and that was because we had this differentiable squashing function here in order to compute this kind of linear, take this linear W transpose X, which could be anywhere from minus infinity to infinity, and we wanted to change it into something that was 0 or 1, so or between 0 and 1. So that's how we had the squashing function. But what if we did something a lot simpler? What if we just had a step function? So instead of using the sigmoid here, we'll just use a function that's 1 if its argument z is positive, and 0 otherwise. And this gives you something called a perceptron. So a perceptron is just a very simple linear classifier. It says, oops, that should be a boldface W. So it should have a little backslash in front of it. So what all this says is if I take my weight vector, you know, the same linear discriminant we've already seen, which is, you know, W tilde TX plus W0, if it's positive, estimate that X is class 1, otherwise class 0. So it's everything that we've seen so far. Now, the question is, how am I going to train this? Because if I don't have a differentiable squashing function, I can't use derivatives anymore. Because the derivatives are always 0. You know, it's just a flat function. So what can I do instead of gradient descent? So there's this very simple, very intuitive algorithm. The idea is going to be go through all my training examples. If I classify them right, don't do anything. If I classify them wrong, make a little adjustment to the weight vector. So let's see what that looks like. So this algorithm here is called the perceptron learning rule. It was most famously studied by Rosenblatt in the 50s, although there is some of the ideas appeared in previous work. And so what you do is each iteration of the algorithm, you loop through your training set, you compute the, this should be the sign, so you compute the, sorry, what you do is you compute y hat from this equation here. So this should actually be f of WTXI, where f is that step function that we saw on the first slide. So you compute the prediction. If it had the right answer, so if it's equal to yi in the training data, do nothing. Otherwise, what you do is take the weight vector and you add this thing to it. You add the class label times xi. So the idea behind this is if the I see the other thing that I did wrong. Okay, too many mistakes in this slide. Okay, the other thing that I did wrong in these slides, and this is just an issue of notation. So let me explain what this is supposed. So what this line is supposed to do is if yi is a positive example, I want to add the feature vector xi to the weight vector. If yi was a negative example and I got it wrong, I want to subtract xi from the weight vector. Why did I write it this way if yi was supposed to be 0 or 1? It was because I meant yi to be minus 1 or 1. And then what happens here is I'm just adding or subtracting depending on what the correct label of instance I was. So that's what the algorithm is. The second question is, why on earth would you want to do this? So you can actually go through something simple, which is kind of the same reasoning that we went through when we talked about why the logistic regression gradient made sense. And that was, how do I make this thing, yeah, that should usually go away, I don't know. Say I had a training example, it's really in class 1, and I got it wrong. So I want to make some update to the weight vector. So what that means is I'm going to take my old weight vector that got it wrong, and I'm going to add in xi. So what happens after with that new weight vector if I take the dot product of xi again? And the answer is that it gets bigger. The reason is, let's say I take this new weight vector, wtxi, and I multiply it by, and I take the dot product with xi again. Well, the dot product is additive. So there's going to be, it's distributive. So there's going to be two terms. The first term was the old dot product, WTXI, and the second term was plus 1 times XI transpose XI. Well, so that thing has to be positive, right? Because the dot product of a vector with itself is its length squared. So what I'm taking my old dot product and adding a positive number. So what that means is, if I started with something where the training example was supposed to be 1, and I predicted the wrong thing, then after the update, my new value of this dot product gets bigger, which is what I want, because I want that dot product to be positive on this positive training example. And the analogous thing happens in the other case, where it was supposed to be minus 1, and I got it wrong. So that's why you'd want to do this rule. There's an amazing thing about this rule. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep looping through the training data until all of the examples are correctly classified. So the first question you might have is, does this algorithm ever terminate? Maybe I never get all of the examples right, and I just keep looping around forever. So there's an amazing fact. The amazing fact is, if the data are linearly separable, then this algorithm actually terminates. It's guaranteed to terminate, and it converges to a weight vector that separates the data. So it's kind of, you know, I find it a little bit surprising that you can just do this and it does work the way you would hope. Now, if the data isn't separable, then that doesn't necessarily converge. So you have to do something extra to pick the weight vector. And there are a couple tricks for doing that, which we won't go through. Now, there are two reasons that I wanted to talk about this algorithm. It's, you know, maybe not by itself considered a state-of-the-art algorithm. You know, it has a little bit of a maybe frumpy reputation, but it's actually not that bad, especially if you do a basis expansion of x, like we were talking about. And there's a particular trick for computing this basis expansion of x that we're going to talk about next week, and that's called the kernel trick. And when we take that and add that to the perceptron, we actually get something that's that can be very useful in practice. The other reason I wanted to talk about the perceptron is that, you know, it's also kind of, you can think of it as a very simple kind of neural network, which we'll also talk about next week. So there are connections between this simple algorithm and some of the more advanced algorithms that we're going to talk about in the rest of this lecture and next week. So that's all I want to say about the perceptron. It's this really very simple thing. It's even more simple if there aren't typos in my slides. So are, do you have any questions about the perceptron algorithm? Okay, because if not, I will finally go to something I have been promising to inflict on you for some time, and that is the support vector machine. So let's see. So the support vector machine is another kind of linear classifier. It's one of the most, I'll stop that. Well, I mean, that one's fine, but it's one of the most advanced classifiers that we have. It's one of the most popular classifiers. It's also one of the more difficult ones to understand geometrically and mathematically. So we're going to go through it, try to go through this slowly. You know, no classifier wins all of the time, right? There's no classifier that's always best. You know, you can actually prove theoretical results about this. But the support vector machine is often really, really good. So it is good to know about. So there are actually two ideas in the support vector machine. And we're going to go through the first one today and the next one on Monday. So the first idea is, it's really a geometric idea. It's something called maximum margin classification. And the second one is a trick for computing this maximum margin classifier in really high dimensional spaces. And that trick is called the kernel trick. So let's start with maximum margin. So a support vector machine is going to be a linear classifier. So in order to derive it, we're going to have to remember some kind of linear vector arithmetic, facts about vectors that you will have seen before. But, you know, if you haven't used them for a while, they might be a little bit rusty. So I'll just remind you of some things. The main thing you need to remember is what a dot product really means. There's several ways to interpret a dot product. This is the one that we really need in order to make this explanation. And that is, if I've got two vectors, x and w, then the dot product WTX is the length of the projection of x onto w, if w is a unit vector. So geometrically, what that means is if I've got some length b, which is I take the vector x, I find the point on this ray, on this line defined by w, that's closest to x, that's going to be this point here. And and the vector from here to here is going to be orthogonal to this line. Okay? So what the question is, what is this length? The projection is this length b. It's the distance from the origin to this point that's got a right angle on it. That length is the projection. So it turns out the projection is WTX. So it's also it's a signed quantity. So if x pointed down here, you'd get a negative dot product. And if you don't remember this, that's fine. The supplementary maths notes on the course website, they're listed under Lecture 1, and they contain an explanation of from first principles about why this is true. It's about a side. It's not, or the part that explains this. It's about a side. So this is a really nice geometric interpretation of the dot product that we're going to use. Okay, so as I said, the support vector machine is this linear classifier. So here was this example that we had of linear classification. I've got some points in class. Now, this time, I remembered to put the class labels correctly. So for this lecture, it's just going to make the math a little bit more convenient to write down. We're going to have the class labels be minus 1 and 1. So this is just a trick to make the algebra easier. And the hyperplane is going to be the same as before. I'm going to have a linear classifier. The decision boundary is going to be W transpose X plus W0. So that means that the set of all points that satisfy this equation is a hyperplane, as we've seen before. And W is a normal vector to the hyperplane because the dot product between this and any of these vectors is 0. Okay, so this is called a separating hyperplane because all of the points are on either one side. All of the positive points are on one side and all of the negative points are on the other. But this is only one of the separating hyperplanes that I could have had. You know, because these points are separable, I could wiggle this around and I'd be a lot of different hyperplanes. So for example, this is the one I showed you before. It seems all right. If I showed you these two clouds of data and I asked you to draw a line between them, you'd probably draw a line that looks something like this. You probably wouldn't draw a line that looks like this. I mean, there's a technical term for this, and that's that this is a crap separating hyperplane, okay? And so if you think about this, because, you know, why would I, you know, this is the same set of points. Why would I pick this plane rather than this one? You know, this one is kind of making this assumption that these points over here must be in the zero class. But that doesn't make a lot of sense because they're actually closer to the X's than they are to the O's. So why should I assume that some point in this region is actually an O? You know, it makes more sense to draw my plane in such a way that it's not any closer to the X's than it is to the O's. And that's something that kind of, you know, if I just told you, you know, you need to come up with a linear rule to separate these classes, you'd probably do something that kind of has equal space between both point clouds. So there's a way to formalize this notion of having equal space, and that's what we're going to do in this lecture. And that notion is called the margin. So what the margin is, this is a geometric concept. It's just the distance between the hyperplane and the closest point in the training data. So again, if I have a hyperplane here, and this is the normal vector to the hyperplane, what I can do is I could start at the decision boundary, and I'll take a set of lines, and I'll just kind of move them out. I'll move them gradually outwards from the decision boundary until I hit one of the training points. Once I hit one of the training points, that's the closest one. And the perpendicular distance, so this distance from here to here, or from here to here, that's the margin. Okay, so what we're going to do in a maximum margin classifier is we're going to find the decision boundary that maximizes this distance. that maximizes the distance to the closest training point. So that gives me the biggest gap between the two classes. Yeah, was there? So if I have something that, so this is defined only, so for a separating hyperplane, or I guess for any hyperplane, I can say take the distance, that's right, the distance between, yeah, I should be a little bit more careful when I say this. It's for a separating what you want is to maximize the gap between the two classes. If I am actually separating, I want to maximize. Okay, so here's the thing: if I'm separating both of the classes, so if this is actually a separating hyperplane, then the gap, then maximizing the gap from here to here is the same as maximizing the gap between this and the closest one of these two, right? Because if I move this closer to one or the other, then if I had some other hyperplane that's like, say, here, right? So that's gonna be closer to this training point, right? So it's not, so if I'm maximizing, so what I'm saying is if I'm maximizing the gap between here and here, then that's the same as maximizing, as trying to maximize the gap between this and the closest one of these two points. But if it's easier, you can think of it as, yeah, that's right. If it's easier, you can think of it as maximizing the gap, the distance from the closest positive point to the decision boundary and the closest negative point to the decision boundary. I don't know if I answered. So let me, I mean, it might be a little bit more clear. The first thing I want to do actually is talk about how we can actually compute, given any point, whether it's positive or negative, how do I compute the gap between this and the decision boundary? So let me start with that, and then we can go back to this point if it's, yeah. Okay, I'm gonna take two steps in order to get an equation for the margin. The first step I wanna do is I actually want to compute the perpendicular distance from the origin to the separating hyperplane. That's going to be the first step. So what I want is I've got this hyperplane W transpose X plus W0. And I want to compute this distance B between the origin and the hyperplane. So I've given you a little bit of a hint about how to do this in the beginning of the lecture. So what do you think? What do you want to use to compute a distance that, so do you have any ideas about how I'd compute that? Of what? Of any point on the hyperplane. So if I take the dot product of any point on the hyperplane with...
The vector that goes from the origin to any point on the hyperplane.
Okay, so I can take this vector here, I can compute the dot product with this. So that would give me the length of this if W were a unit vector. So that's kind of essentially what we're going to do, I think. Yeah, but I'm going to present this in a little bit of a different way. But I think that's essentially the operation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to imagine taking this vector and I'm going to multiply it by a scalar until I hit the hyperplane. Okay. So I take this thing W. I'll divide it by the norm to make it a unit vector, and then I'll multiply it by some scalar until I hit the hyperplane. So once I do that, then that constant that I had to multiply the vector to, that's going to be the distance that I want, right? Because if I've got some unit vector and then I multiply it by b, then the length of that new vector is b, and I'm just going to keep doing that until I'm actually on the hyperplane. So I'm going to define this vector z, which is going to be this point here where I intersect. And what I want to do is I want to solve for b. So well, what I know about z is it actually fits. It satisfies this equation because it sits on the hyperplane. So what I can do is I'm going to start with, so I'm going to start saying what's on the hyperplane, so WTZ plus W0 equals 0. And I said I wanted to solve for B in this thing, so I'll substitute it in. And what I get is that it's just the bias over the norm of W. So all I did here is I said WT this thing equals 0, and I did some algebra to solve for B. So what that gives us is actually the distance. So that gives us this thing B that we wanted. So that's part one. So now I know what the length from the origin to the hyperplane is. So the next part that I want is actually computing the distance, the perpendicular distance from some point here to the hyperplane. And this is where I am going to need to use that thing about the dot product. Okay, so if I've got some point here, x, I want this perpendicular distance here. I'll call that c. That's the same thing as this perpendicular distance down here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this thing b that I already computed, and I'm going to subtract this thing, the projection of x onto w, the length of that projection. I'll call that a. And that'll give me this thing that's left. That'll give me this thing C. So now, if I, so now, what is A? Everybody. Everybody. Yes. Let's see. No, I'm not, okay. No, that's not a very good joke. So I'm not going to say that. So yeah, if you said, I couldn't tell what you said. If you said the dot product, you were almost right. It is the dot product if I normalize W first, right? Because remember, the dot product gave me the length of the projection if I was projecting onto a unit vector. So what I get is actually this thing. So then when I subtract the two, this is the thing that I get, okay? It is what I get is the perpendicular distance from any point to the hyperplane is the... is W is the norm of W times WTX plus W0, this discriminant, the absolute value of this discriminant function that we've already seen. And this thing here is the distance from the closest training point to the hyperplane. Okay, so now maybe should I go back to your question again, or are you okay?
No.
Okay, you're okay, okay. So now what I want to do is I want to maximize this. I want to maximize this thing under the constraint that I actually classify all of the training vectors correctly. So I'm going to have this constrained optimization problem, and that's going to be the max margin problem. So there's one other thing that we have to fix before we can really write that down. And that is that, because that there's this difficulty in identifying a linear hyperplane. So if I tell you, here's a hyperplane that that separates the data. I'll give you this W and this W0. This is a hyperplane, and say I tell you, it has a really good margin, and it separates all the training data. Then you can give me another hyperplane that's just as good. All you have to do is multiply W and W0 by a constant. And you can see that these two vectors actually define the same decision boundary if you use them for a linear classifier. And that's because if there's some point I'm classifying as 1, I'll do that if this linear function is greater than 0. Well, if I multiply both of these by a constant, it's still going to be greater than 0, by a positive constant. So there's some scale. So whatever optimization problem we have, changing this constant C isn't going to affect how far apart the hyperplane and the points are. We want to get a definite answer. You know, we don't want to have an optimization problem that has infinitely many possible solutions. So what we're going to do is add an additional constraint to the problem when we maximize it. And what that constraint is going to do is identify the scale of C. So it's basically going to be like picking the units of X. It's It's going to be like deciding whether X is measured in meters. You know, is my margin 1 meter or is my margin 1,000 millimeters? Right? It's basically about, you know, putting a standard scale on that. And it turns out the most convenient way to do that mathematically is to pick the scale in a very, very, very strange way. And what we're going to do is the scale is going to be, we're going to scale them such that this distance is 1. So what that means is we said the distance to the closest training point was 1 over w times this the absolute value of this discriminant. So now that we've chosen, so now we're going to say you have to choose C in order to make this thing be 1. So now the margin is always going to be 1 over the norm of w, now that we've added this constraint. So this is, So now that we have this, let's go through and actually try to write down an optimization algorithm that will describe the maximum margin solution. So what I want to say is, I want to maximize the margin, which we've now kind of reduced to 1 over the norm of w, subject to some constraints. The constraints are going to be, first, I need to classify every training example correctly. I'm only going to talk about linearly separable data sets this week, and then next week I'll talk about what to do if the data set is non-separable. So I'm going to add these constraints that say every data item has to be classified correctly. So in particular, if yi equals 1, I'm going to have one constraint for each item in the data set, for each training instance. If that training instance is 1, that constraint is going to say this linear discriminant, wtxi plus w0, that has to be greater than 0. If the real answer is minus 1, then this thing has to be less than 0. So I get that correct. And then also, I'm going to have this additional constraint that I need in order to make sure that this thing really is the margin that we introduce from the next slide. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to simplify that a couple times. So the first thing I'm going to do is it turns out these two constraints are too loose, right? Because I've already said all, says here I'm saying this thing has to be greater, this thing WTXI plus W0 has to be greater than or equal to 0. But we also know that the minimum of the absolute value, the absolute value of this thing is greater than or equal to 1. Because that's what this minimum says. So now that once I have this constraint, I know not only is WTXI plus W0 greater than or equal to 0, it also has to be greater than or equal to 1, because otherwise this thing wouldn't be satisfied. So if this constraint is satisfied, then these two constraints are actually actually equivalent. So I can say, well, actually, WTXI plus W0 has to be either bigger than 1 or it has to be less than negative 1. So that's the first step. So that's the first step in simplifying it. But now we can do something even more. Once we've done that, we can actually blow away this constraint. Because since all of these things are now greater than or equal to 1, or less than or equal to minus 1, then the minimum of their absolute values, that's something else I need to explain, yes. The third constraint is redundant, it's a little bit convoluted to think about. What I'm going to argue is, if I maximize this and these two constraints are satisfied, then this constraint is automatically satisfied. So this is kind of a little bit more subtle to see. I'm going to say this again. If I have maximized this thing and the first two constraints are satisfied, then the third constraint is also satisfied. And the reason for that is, suppose none of these constraints, suppose this constraint wasn't satisfied, that would mean all of these things are loose. All of these discriminants are strictly greater than 1 or minus 1. So then it turns out I could rescale the problem in order to make one of these things be, the smallest one of these things be equal to 1. That would also make this thing bigger. So again, the argument was, if this thing wasn't satisfied, and these things were, then I could come up with a better value for this objective function. So at the maximum, this constraint is redundant. This is, again, it's kind of a bit subtle to go through, but this is also described in a handout that's on the website. So if the slides are a little bit elliptical, you can also go through and see what it says in the handout. Okay, so now that's nice because it lets us drop this constraint. And so we can simplify to this thing. And so now we're going to do two more things. These things are going to be a little bit easier than the ones on the previous slide. So the first thing we're going to do is I'm going to write this a little bit more compactly. I'm going to write this as one set of constraints, rather than two set of constraints. And what I'm going to do is kind of the same trick that I did in the perceptron slides. I'm going to say that the true value yi times this discriminant has to be greater than or equal to 1. So for the positive examples, that's just going to give me wtxi plus w0 is greater than or equal to 1, which is what I had up here. For the negative examples, it's going to give me minus 1 times wtxi plus w0 is greater than or equal to 1, which is, if I multiply both sides by negative 1, is the second line of the top optimization problem. So what that shows you is that this second version of the optimization problem is just a more compact way of writing the top version of the optimization problem. So the final thing we're going to do is that maximizing 1 over the norm of W is the same thing as minimizing the norm of W squared. So if I want to maximize 1 over x, it's the same because 1 over x is a monotonic. If I want to maximize 1 over x, that's the same thing as minimizing x. So that's what we're going to use here. And so that finally, after we do all of that, we get a very pretty looking optimization problem. It's not nearly as ugly as the one we started with. And that is that maximizing the margin is equivalent, under some constraints, to minimizing the norm. And that's actually kind of interesting. So the optimization problem that we end up with is the minimum over all possible weight vectors of the norm of the weight vector squared under the constraint that every training example is classified correctly, and its classification isn't just zero, you've got a bit of a gap. So the classification has the correct sign, and it's greater than or equal to 1. So to find a maximum margin classifier, what you need to do is you use a numerical optimization procedure, one that's complex because that needs to be able to handle those constraints. But I need a numerical method that will solve this optimization problem. So the interesting thing about that, we don't have the maths that are necessary to go through those algorithms that would actually solve this optimization problem. So you're just going to have to trust me that when you put it in this form, there is an off-the-shelf black box algorithm that you can run that will solve this problem. But I'll show you, it turns out the solution has a really interesting mathematical form, and we'll go through that next time. The one comment that I want to make about this, which is kind of interesting, is we said maximizing the margin is equivalent now to minimizing the norm. So has there been anything else in this class where you had to minimize the norm of a weight vector? Yes.
Regression.
Yes. So in ridge regression, remember there was some penalty on the norm of the weight vector to say, oh, I really want a weight vector that has small weights, so it doesn't use too many of the feature functions. And this is actually kind of doing something similar here. But now we derived it rather than just saying that I wanted the weight vector to have a small norm. We actually derived it from this geometric principle of the margin. Okay. So that's part one of support vector machines. So that's the maximum margin classifier. And next time we'll talk about part two, which is the kernel trick. Oh yeah, for the assignment, yeah, you need to send that.
Talking about the max margin.
Okay. Let me see. Okay, so that's what I have. Different maximums on either side. Okay. What do you mean? Okay. Yeah, okay, so you're saying, let me see if I get this.
You're saying, say I have some point that's like, maybe the points are like this. So you're saying, and this side, the closest point is over here. And this side, the closest point is over here. Then, what I can do is I can, so what I said is I just started with, so I said, oh, take the distance of the closest point, right? But since I'm maximizing that, I can just move, what I can do is to maximize the closest distance, I can actually move this out. And I'll make the distance bigger. So it turns out, so at the maximum margin solution, the distance to the closest positive point and the closest negative point is 0. Is equal.
Do you have anything up for this?
Yes, at 3:30, I think, but I can postpone that.
No, that's fine. So, depending on when you get done, if you think we can talk before 3:30 about the tutorial,
okay.
5:30 also works, but it's sort of not the idea.
Okay, that's fine. I'll come by your office when this is done.
If there's still time.
Okay, yeah. Yes. Yes. It's just a trick. So it's something I could have set C to anything I want, and what I'm setting C to is 1/1 this minimum.
I mean, it's also possible to
But for which point?
This I is the index of X.
Yeah.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hi, yes, Charles. I have a question. Could I see you probably later on some other day to discuss two things? My IRR, that I'm choosing the topic you suggested, and I want a bit more information about it.
Okay.
And second, the PhD options.
Okay. That's fine. So let me just get my diary. I think it would if. Yeah. Oh yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Let me just get it out of your way. And there's the. So I think Tuesday would be best, or
all
Tuesday
right.
or later would be best, because I have
Monday, Tuesdays, okay.
Yeah. So if you, let me just get
are
this.
Any chance, are you available maybe Monday?
Monday could be a little bit tough.
I'm free almost all day, but on Tuesdays I'm only free after 4, something.
Okay. I could do Wednesday, or I could do after probably, or I could do after 4 on Tuesday. It's Monday's a bit tough because I have a deadline. So I could do, let's see, so after 4. So I could do like